Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
The celebration is on. It's still theirs until someone rips it out of their hands.
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast alongside Chris Rosenthal. I'm Kevin Brown for Inside Lacrosse. Rosie, we are down to four. Gone is the quarterfinal stage. Hello to the semifinals in Philadelphia. Minnesota, you did not disappoint. The fun atmosphere. Two exact scores. What? In one night on Saturday night, Rosie. The Redwoods and the Water Dogs move on to face the Outlaws and Atlas, respectively. Rosie, how you doing? And what'd you make of quarterfinal weekend?
I am feeling great. I am getting ready for what I think is probably the best weekend of the pro lacrosse year. We get two super huge matchups fighting for one more matchup. So cannot wait. Cannot wait to get in to see what happens with these guys. Just going back a little bit, like you said, quarterfinal matchups, both incredibly exciting, both pretty close throughout, you know what I mean? Even if a team jumped out significantly, the other ones were getting ready to fight and scrap back into it. Basically what you would expect from teams fighting for another week together.
Both games were honestly crazy. We have to talk about them a little bit. They set the stage for September 1st. If you don't have any Labor Day Monday plans, get to Subaru Park in Chester, Pennsylvania. Noon. For the Eastern semifinal between the Water Dogs and Atlas, and then 3 p.m. or whenever that high-scoring, whatever, hopefully overtime game finishes, the Redwoods versus Outlaws on ESPN2 as well for the second game there. And then we got the Stars and Stripes at the end. The action on ESPNU. So a very fun day indeed, as you mentioned, Rosie. But to get there, we had to get through a couple 14-12 outcomes at TCO Stadium in Minneapolis, or right outside Eagan, Minnesota. The atmosphere is great. The Minnesota Vikings facilities were pleasing to players, coaches alike. So it was great to see a good atmosphere and a knowledgeable fans show out, because like you said, Rosie, neither game was a blowout, and there were maybe certain stances where it was looking like it. like the Whipsnakes did not feel like they deserved to be in that first game, man. And then all of a sudden they start coming back. And they're hanging in there. They're hanging in there in the first half. The second half, they somehow hit like five pipes. And I'm like, all right. One, it's a tie game at 12-12. Brad Smith coming off the two-pointer. Great play drawn up from Drew Snyder and Jim Stagnita. Nails it, offside hit. Bang, 12-12. And hits a few more pipes, and then Kieran McArdle takes it from there, Rosie. Goals 5 and 6 on the night, 14 shots. First attack trio to all score 4 goals in a playoff game. Michael Sowers goes off for 4 and 4. CJ Kirst goes off for 4 and 1. Cue the Connor Schellenberger take from last week when we asked him about it, right? He's like, yeah. We all thought these guys were pretty good, so give CJ some time to heal up from injury like I did with mine. And yeah, look what happens, Rosie, when you poke the three-headed monster that is the Water Dogs attacking it.
Yeah, that lineup looked just terrifying, right? Scored all of their goals, which is just remarkable, super bizarre trivia. We had seen Michael Sowers, look, not having bad games by any standards in the previous meetings this season, but This one was consistent and highly productive throughout. Kieran McArdle, he kind of played that veteran role where, you know, things are close. The teams are kind of, you know, jockeying for position late. He kind of steps in as that sort of senior authority and says, you know, enough is enough. I'm going to end this. kind of preyed on Maryland making perhaps a switch. Maybe they would do a little differently next time around or play a little bit differently. Having a short stick, trying to cover McArdle behind X like that, go step for step with him. Maybe they underestimated his speed. Maybe they overestimated his age. Whatever the case may be, he definitely made him pay for it. And then the last goal, just super emphatic. I think if you were trying to think of the perfect goal, kind of to set the tone and let everybody know, okay, this is the Water Dogs team you're going to have to deal with in Philadelphia for the semis, that last goal was just it, the perfect definition. You had like CJ Kirst driving with it to start the, you know, to kind of start the chaos right away and get everybody real nervous about what he's going to do because he's just so quick. So he starts on that alley to initiate. Maryland's already freaked out. Quick kicks it down to Sowers at X, and then you're like, uh-oh, now we're double freaked out because, you know, this guy's got 7 points and he's at X. What's he going to do? And then quick whip over to McArdle for the finish. And it's like, yeah, this is a sample of what we're going to do all game next time as well. So if you're a Water Dogs fan, you have to feel just through the roof seeing them put it all together with that attack line as they head home this next weekend.
I don't think the Whipsnakes underestimated Kieran McArdle's speed as much as they did his low angle shooting, because man, he was still behind that net when he lets that go for his fifth, the eventual winner, 13-12. You mentioned the emblematic, emphatic stamp of 14 on there with all three of those guys involved. Like, it is kind of a little bit of worrying that, like, you had so much productivity out of your attack unit. Yes, you hit a couple pipes through the midfield, got a little close. We'll see if Mikey Schlosser plays again in the semis. And you can't really put the game away. When you look at the last time they come up against the New York Atlas, 20-19, the end of the regular season, like, fans better be in their seats for this one early. Like, the scoring is going to get started at 12:01 with no seconds on the clock. So get your butts in seats in Subaru Park, because Ryan Boyle said on the broadcast, like, Michael Sowers has been on record saying, like, I need to assert myself early in games, and no one has found an answer for stopping it. So he did so again against Ajax in that really good Maryland defense. So hanging 14 on them, really impressive. The Atlas with some added rest are definitely going to be wary. Any other takeaways from what you saw from Philly in terms of finishing the game off or allowing Maryland to get back in it?
Two quick takeaways, both kind of leaning on the Water Dog side. There was kind of a lot of talk on social media. Obviously, you got to do your stuff to get your tweets and your clicks and everything. But they were talking about, you know, playoff Sowers, you know, postseason Sowers. Look out for Sowers in the postseason, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, no, he, yeah, okay. I believe it. That is a substantial thing. The first time he plays the Whipsnakes earlier this season, 8 points. So, you know, this, as crazy as it sounds, it is not a shocking amount of points that he had in this one. 8 points, bar. But here's the thing. 5 turnovers the previous time, which, I mean, point-to-turnover ratio still isn't the worst, but it is still 5 turnovers. This past game, 1 turnover. Like, that is clean. That is a real clean sheet. And McArdle had 1. You know, they weren't really they weren't sloppy. They were methodical. Stepping away from the attack for a second, Zach Kurier was out of his mind this entire game. Just on the wings. He was
everywhere.
Yeah, he was everywhere all the time, doing everything all at once. He was basically what you think of Zach Kurier, but turned up to the nth degree. You could just almost see it was like he was like a Wolverine or a Badger or something, just constantly going for these ground balls. If you did, in fact, get to a ground ball first, he was all over the hands, forcing turnovers. You know, if he's getting knocked down, he's still throwing passes with one hand. He's never giving up on any play or anything like that. That was another guy who really kind of made me think more about that whole concept of players stepping on the gas or shifting into another gear come postseason time. You know, obviously not that they drag the rest of the way, but, you know, maybe you do have to reach a little bit deeper, and maybe that separates somebody like a Zach Kurier from some other guys. So just, yeah, totally blown away. Not at all surprised, because we've seen it for years from him, but still, remarkable performance from him.
Head coach Bill Tierney going from last place to now in the semifinals. Asked all season long about the goalie battle between Dylan Ward and Matt DeLuca. DeLuca finishes with 10 saves, played the full 48, 47.6%. You know, Rosie, the defense for Philly has been kind of fascinating to follow this year in terms of they had that big three with maybe not a big three because they were unheralded players kind of gelling together so nicely for that championship run. Eli Gobrecht, Liam Burns, Ben Randall, the holdover this year, playing with Kenny Brower, basically his rookie season after missing all last year. Jimmy Freehill, a natural rookie who, once he's inserted into the lineup, pushes Marcus Hudgens into the LSM position. Both of them involved in that game-sealing defensive stop. Maryland doing everything they can to draw something up to get a two-point look, and it is so much harder in lacrosse than it is in basketball to get a last-second beyond the arc good look, as Aiden Carroll can attest to, because you see Marcus Hudgens and Jimmy Freehill pressing out, and that kind of length and pressure, it's hard to get a good look off. So kudos to those guys for kind of sticking with the haymakers that they knew Maryland was going to throw at them. You know, they're the two-time champs culture team for a reason. Battling back, they talked about it post-game of, like, they just weren't able to play a full 48. Yes, that's coach speak, but yeah, they also didn't play very well in the first half. Let a few ones go early to start the third quarter coming out of halftime, and then really woke up. So a really good battle, Rosie. Kudos to Philly for moving on. And honestly, the best part about it is getting the Philly team to advance to Philly.
Yeah, you know, Philly has had, you know, during their championship times at Subaru Park, we have seen a serious Water Dogs support group. Even before they were literally, you know, the Philadelphia Water Dogs, Philly has always turned out very big for the Water Dogs. It was almost inevitable that they would end up formally representing the team just because of the kind of support we've seen from them, from their fan group. So getting them all back like this, you know, it's not the championship, but the semifinals that, you know, can help get that team to the championship. I expect a very big crowd rooting for the Water Dogs, it's going to be a bit to overcome for their opponent.
Rosie, I don't think we need to spend too much time. We didn't really give an in memoriam RIP section for Utah or Boston either. So I will have a piece out on InsideLacrosse.com kind of contrasting the you know, the different feelings of the Whipsnakes really did feel like they had a championship caliber team. So them crashing out of the first round is definitely a little bit of gutting, acquiring a lot of offensive talent that played really well at times, a defense that led the league in scoring average versus, you know, a Carolina group moving over and transitioning to the Western Conference quarterfinal where, you know, it was a battle of who could arrive earlier and get to the semis. And, you know, both teams even making it to the playoffs over the two-time defending champs is a feat in itself. And you heard the fiery post-game speech from Blaze Reardon post-game. If you follow the chaos on socials, like, man, he is a leader. Like, I would love to play for Blaze Reardon as my goalie. I mean, what defender won, obviously, but as a guy in the locker room, him being like, just instilling that self-recognition of, listen, we had like six guys for like months, and suddenly they got 20 more, including Roy Colsey and Spencer Ford, Jack Snyker, Owen Hiltz leading the way. A one possession loss in the playoffs is nothing to scoff at. So great season, Carolina, but Rosie, for the Redwoods to pull this off required a gutsy comeback down. I think they were getting doubled up in the first half, regroup at halftime, and man, did Chris Kavanaugh and Andrew McAdoy show up in this one. Another 14-12 win. And what'd you make of California's ability to keep proving me and everyone else wrong?
Well, I mean, sometimes there's just not an answer for that kind of speed, right? Like, that's what I think about when I see this Redwoods team. You do have, you have this one guy in Dylan Malloy who is just a wrecking ball and does things very different in his regard. But when you look at McAdory and when you look at Kavanaugh, it's just a nightmare to try to cover these guys. And what they really seem to feed on a lot, we saw a lot of it in this past game against Carolina, is constantly making their opponents either switch or to decide what to do on the picks, get these short stick matchups. And Kavanaugh will just, you know, I think him or McAdory, if they see anything that resembles a weakness, they really just attack straight at their opponent. And it's difficult to, you know, put up a front against that at any time, let alone for the entire, you know, 48 minutes. And Chris Kavanaugh, we've seen this throughout the year. You know, I guess it's just a matter of confidence, you know, the way he attacks the goal. But he also has, not to pin this as a one-on-one sort of thing, but he looks very comfortable shooting against Blaze Reardon. You know, we always hear about the goalies understanding the shooter tendencies. If a goalie knows to, say, drop his stick because that's where the shooter, you know, starts his release because he's done the thousands of hours of scouting on him. But Kavanaugh looks to have a very strong understanding of what he should do when he's going against Blaze. He looked very comfortable, you know, dropping the stick and then absolutely shellacking these top corners. It just worked out very well for him. It was a really strong performance by a lot of people who must just be an absolute nuisance to try to cover.
You know, I wrote a kind of half the cover story for the Face Off Yearbook magazine before the college season when Notre Dame's coming off two national championships. Chris Kavanaugh, the most outstanding player in the latter. And, like, just the... I know this isn't the case because his knowledge and expertise in the stringing realm would render him a very knowledgeable when it comes to where his own shot is going to go. But man, does it feel like when he's letting that loose, like it can go anywhere, which makes him being so accurate all the more impressive because he is yanking that thing.
Yeah, he's got rider wrists, right? Like we see Garnsey do it with one hand. Cav does it with two, and it doesn't look like a lot of bicep or tricep or anything shoulder related. It just kind of seems like it goes flying around, and then he just hockey style just kind of yanks it, and it's incredible to see. Let me say one thing real quick. I just kind of thought of this now. I know we did superlatives recently, but I would say this, and not going through the entire league, but I don't think there's a matchup I would pay more money to see, you know, over and over again than Jack Rowlett versus Dylan Malloy.
Oh, yeah.
That was a strong one-on-one. And I think that it is really great that we have them in the same conference because, you know, Malloy tries the, you know, wrecking ball and Rowlett is here for it. And, you know, he won a couple, Malloy won a couple. But it is a mixture of highly physical versus highly quick that is, it's like seeing two giant pro wrestlers who can also climb the ropes. It was a heck of a matchup.
Oh, 100%. And it's, you know, we've loved the Jack Rowlett, Michael Sowers matchups for years, Rosie.
Loved them.
This has just been just absolute cinema, Martin Scorsese meme of them going at it. 100% ditto that sentiment because that was the other most interesting thing of when you play the Redwoods, like, this Chaos crew in particular knows their assignments. That's what makes them, you know, so reliable, so consistent. Jared Newman's going to play the lefty. He's going to play Ryder. And Jack Rowlett's going to, you know, usually match the quicker feet guy. But when you got a guy of Dylan Malloy's build, you need someone to ram against him. And that seemingly had to be Rowlett. So that left Troy Ray on Chris Kavanaugh, which, looking forward, I'm really interested to see or go back and see how Denver played California in the regular season because, you know, yeah, Mike Manley, kind of similar on Ryder, you would expect, right? Jesse Bernhardt, who does he cover versus who does JT Giles Harris cover? You'd probably expect Jesse on Dylan Malloy and JT Giles Harris on Chris Kavanaugh. And I think that's a better matchup because you need a guy who is more consistently on those top player matchups to kind of run with and run around those screens that Chris Kavanaugh likes to use. So a guy that I know knows a lot about how to navigate screens and defensive schemes is, you know, a very charismatic Californian. We've been trying to get him on the podcast for weeks. He was tough to nail down a few weeks back, but the Redwoods kept winning. Let's turn to our guest, Cole. We welcome on California Redwoods defenseman Cole Kastner to the show. Cole, welcome.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Kevin. Nice to see you guys. Thanks for having me on.
As I alluded to pre-recording here, it's been an appearance weeks in the making with Cole here and with the home stretch of the season. You're on a four-game win streak into the semifinals now, and it's been fun to see you blossom as one of the young pro defensemen in this league. Just what's it been like from a year away from the sport to now gearing up for the PLL semifinals here?
Yeah, it's really a ton of fun. Feel so fortunate to, you know, have gotten to live out a dream and play college basketball and then, you know, get to live out another dream and play a professional sport and be playing professional lacrosse. You know, It definitely wasn't a like direct path for us. You know, started off pretty hot, dropped a couple games in a row. We're kind of figuring out, all right, what's going to make us different? What's going to, you know, help us continue picking up some momentum? And I think we found it. So it's been pretty sweet and can't wait for Monday.
You mentioned the time playing a little college basketball before you jumped in with the Redwoods. Do you feel like there was something you were able to take away from that period that has kind of helped you develop as a pro this year?
Definitely. Definitely. So much. It was an awesome year overall, just in terms of the experience, the people I was doing it with, the coaching staff, you know, the university, being at Stanford. There's so many amazing things in there, but I think it kind of, it kind of reignited like a love or like a passion for the game. You know, playing a year of basketball, doing all new stuff, and then getting another opportunity to compete at the highest level of lacrosse, and you know, figuring out, you know, footwork approaches, different checks, like how I want to guard X player, Y player, whatever it may be. So kind of definitely reinvigorated all that for me.
Cole, you're among the selection of a perfect guest to have on for this week. And I think it's kind of, you know, people would be like, perfect guest, but we want Dylan Malloy or we want Chris Kavanaugh. It's the defense that wins championships in the Love pros and NCAA level, of course, Cole. And nah, man, like, this will be a little bit of a long-winded spiel if you'll indulge me, but just you being the last pick of the draft in 2024, kind of in that group of generational talent that we'll get to a little bit, and your experience guarding these guys of Shelly in practice, three of these guys up for the MVP award this year, Shelly in practice during your Virginia days, ACC battles with Brennan and Pat, your upcoming opponent with Denver in Philly, and the fact of one that the cool story of doing basketball, being away from the sport for a year, and two, just the being the last pick is always a cool angle, but when it's kind of a draft and stash situation with Nat St. Laurent, it's kind of one of the parting gifts he gives you guys with a new look team this year with Anthony Kelly and Joe Spallina. Chris, he reported on it kind of extensively, talking to Chris Gray when he retired and Nat a little bit when he left his post. Just like, it's a little bit of another parting gift of, you know, like conditional trades and like Nat St. Laurent didn't know the full extent of Chris Gray and his ability to maybe be available for these games. The I think trade that opened up your spot playing time wise, kind of he died for our sins a little bit. A conditional pick used with Owen Grant going to Boston. Yeah, kind of a key piece who never really played for much for the Redwoods, except a game when he got injured. And you come in and I want to get your takes on all this, but and we'll kind of circle back to each topic here. But what's it been like just to one join this revamped group and to join former rivals at Notre Dame with, you know, Chris Kavanaugh and Andrew McAdory at Duke, just and seeing them ball out in the quarterfinals here, and now you're doing some playoff business with these guys here in the pro ranks.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think what initially like drew me to the Woods was like the core defensive unit that we had of UVA guys that I got to play with for a year when my freshman year we won national championship. So it was, you know, Jared Connors, Chris Merle, And then on top of that, you know, the offensive studs that I saw, like Charlie Bertrand, and selfishly, like Ricky Miazon was one of my best friends in the whole world when I was at UVA. Having that whole crew there, like that drew me to the team. I know exactly what each one of them is about. And those are people that I would hope to emulate, you know, in my professional career, in sports, in life, as a friend. So that drew me to it. And then to kind of find out that this incoming rookie class that, you know, I guess I kind of get put in that bucket too, are just more of the same incredible people, and guys that, you know, you see on the scouting report for 4 years, maybe you have a couple conversations with, you know, while you're out in the field guarding each other, but nothing more than that to become, you know, best friends with them over a course of 10 weeks. Like that's pretty amazing. So I'd have to compliment our coaching staff and Joe Spallina and the roster that we put together, because it truly is like an incredible locker room. And I think you see, you know, some of the best results on the field when you take care of that first, and that's what they did. So just grateful for that.
You're kind of in an interesting spot that you alluded to for a minute there, because you come in knowing some of the older guys, you know, on the defensive end that you've known for a while. But then also, yeah, you're kind of grouped in with the rookies in that same regard, even though you're not quite in that same technically age group. I guess you've been out a little bit longer. How did you feel exactly? Did you feel more like a newcomer, or did you kind of feel like, you know, maybe a situation where like a kid has an older brother, so he's not quite like, you know, the freshman in school or something like that?
Yeah, totally. I felt like a newcomer. I did. You know, it's a new game. It's a fast game. So many new faces. Been away from it for a little bit. And so overcoming some of those hurdles at first was, you know, I think a big part of my growth and development. And the guys really, and coaching staff, they made it really easy on us. So I'm grateful for Coach Kelly, Collins, Bachley. Like, they're unbelievable people, and they made it easy for us.
Cole, you're featuring in a back line with a couple Notre Dame alums, Yale too, with Chris Fake and Chris Conlon, your Virginia teammate, as you mentioned with Jared Connors at long pole. Just what's it been like gelling with these guys throughout the regular season and into the quarterfinal?
It's been awesome. It's a group that I've always had so much, you know, respect and admiration for. And it's cool, like, from a schematic point of view, like the Notre Dame defense and the Virginia defense is very different. And the fact that, you know, these guys are so capable of being incredibly versatile is amazing. And it's helped me a ton. It's helped, you know, my lacrosse IQ and ability out there. And just so cool to take the best parts of what they did in college and their experience in the pros, and, you know, what we had at Virginia, and you know, merge that together into a pretty solid and I think trending up defensive unit. So yeah, it's been great.
Were there any members, you've given some names there, that you kind of felt like you had to maybe shadow or kind of latch on to particularly get caught on to what the team was going to expect out of your role?
For sure. I think, I mean, just from like, you know, a playing perspective and trying to be the best overall player I can be, anytime you're with Chris Fake and Conlon and Arden Cohen down there, like that's an awesome group to work with. So they helped me, you know, tremendously with my game. And then I think the probably almost more important aspect is, you know, your relationship with the short seat D middies and like how you guys are going to work together. You see a lot of invert play in the PLL and you want to make sure you're communicating as clearly as possible. And like I couldn't think of a better group of three guys that of our short seat D middies. And to top it off with Chase Erland and the goal, like there's not a better person out there. So It's a fun group. It's a gritty group. And yeah, it's been really good.
Well, I want to circle back with Chase, because, you know, he did make 18 saves in your 2-goal win. So he's peaking at the right time for sure. But for you, you missed the first three games. What was it like kind of integrating? What was it like making your debut in kind of a close to home situation with San Diego?
Yeah, it was. So I got a little banged up at training camp. I pulled my hamstring Never, you know, had a hamstring issue before. So was an interesting recovery process, just like trying to work through it and understand, you know, the balance of strengthening, stretching, and pushing through all that stuff. I was really lucky to have access to, you know, our athletic trainer and strength coach at Stanford, which is awesome. Like, they're amazing people, have great relationships with them. And, I was living in Palo Alto, so spent a lot of time with them getting back into it. And then to get to play that first game against Outlaws down in San Diego was amazing. Just really, really cool to have my parents and my girlfriend and family in the stands and share a moment like that with them. 4 years of hard work across the country, and then get to do it, you know, not too far away in California in front of everyone was really sweet. And, you know, the outcome was tough overall of the weekend. But, you know, motivated a lot of good work after that and helped us turn it around.
You know, Kevin just kind of mentioned Chase's big game coming up with all those saves and everything. Was there anything in particular that kind of comes to mind, a big takeaway from your impression from that last game that you feel could really kind of help you guys moving forward onto the next challenge?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think, like, with Chase in particular, like, his approach is incredible. He's just like a fun person to be around when you're on the field, when you're off the field, and like that stuff carries, and that makes every meeting, every hard conversation, all that stuff so much better. So definitely grateful for that, and it rubs off on the whole team. So he plays, you know, a massive, massive role in what we do. And yeah, I think just kind of over the last couple of weeks, solidifying, you know, pick play, understanding the shots that we want to give up, the shots that we don't want, when to push and transition, you know, how to support our face-off unit, and get the ball to our offensive guys who are, you know, killing it. It's all worked out pretty well for us.
Cole, I think most listeners hearing this know that you're just a long 6'7", just can cover a lot of space defenseman. One, how do you describe your own style, strengths? And two, just you mentioned how different Virginia and Notre Dame's defenses were. Just explain that a little bit, and then I want to nerd out with some Shelly and Outlaws talk with you.
For sure. Yeah. I would say, you know, personally, I try and use my length and range as best I can on the lacrosse field. It's been a huge advantage to me, you know, ever since I started as a young basketball player and then would put the cleats on and go out on the field. It just felt like I had so much more space and could use my speed and I'd use the best of my ability to just, you know, crowd hands, make plays, and, you know, similar to kind of how Jared does it out there, flying around, you know, throwing big checks and like diving for, you know, a trail check, stuff like that. Like, it's the way I love to play. So, definitely try to incorporate as much of that into my own game. And then I guess, you know, from a UVA, Notre Dame perspective, Notre Dame, I think, is, you see a lot of crease sliding wherever they are on the field. Right. And, they're not as particular about matchups. You know, they'll change matchups plenty of times during a possession. And it simplifies a lot of things, and, you know, they're year in and year out, a incredible defense. Where that becomes complicated is you have someone like you're talking about, like Shelly, or, you know, some of the Outlaws attackmen, and now you have one of those guys dodging a short stick, which, you know, that's a whole nother conversation we could have about the PLL. I remember first game, Dalton Young is like, he was like running out of the box, and, you know, we played him plenty at Richmond. He's obviously an incredible player. Just crazy right. To see a short stick on a guy like that. But, you know, the short sticks are, you know, even better too. So, it all works out. But yeah, so I would say that's a pretty major difference. We were a little bit more concerned about matchups. You know, you try and get through picks as opposed to switching them. And, you know, that's just inevitably a major part of communication that you have to sort out when there are two fundamental differences. Because if the assumption in one person's mind is, you know, we're going to switch everything, the assumption in someone else's mind is, I'm going to get through this and stick with my matchup, it's too high of a level. There's not, you know, there's some margin of error so thin, you're going to score a goal in the PLL. Like if there's those type of communications. So, you know, Coach Collins has done an awesome job ironing all that stuff out for us and, you know, being flexible and adaptable, and yeah, making it work.
And not to mention the fact that the field's shorter and everyone is so good at clearing, obviously, with the high IQ kind of defensive players in this league, right, that you can't really, like, 10-man anymore. So it's like you're not bumping up to the midfield and creating havoc that way with Jared. So it's do you miss any of the 10-man riding?
And yeah, you have no idea. That's my could have been my favorite part of my experience at UVA playing lacrosse there. Like the 10-man ride is just so much fun, and you kind of feel like a free safety, like in football or like a basketball kind of term. I would think of as like a 1-3-1, like press, and you're the top guy going back and forth trying to make plays and figuring out where you need to trap and stuff like that. But that was just such a fun position for me, and you know, learned it from Jared, and LT worked hard on trying to get me in the right spots and figure it out. And so, yeah, I missed that for sure. It's a great part of the game.
So we talked about, you know, Virginia defense a little bit, Notre Dame as well. I wanted to get your thoughts on Stony Brook. You guys bring in Rylan Reese not too long ago, a few weeks ago. Serious sort of veteran presence. He's got himself a ring, been around international level, pretty much everything. What has working with someone like that been able to kind of teach you or show you just a little bit of his game as well?
For sure. Yeah. Reese has been awesome. His voice, like over the last 3 weeks, has been like unbelievable. He has so much poise and experience in these type of big games. So, you know, that's been super valuable for us. Obviously he's like a fantastic player. I want to say maybe in the fourth quarter, the one goal game, and I had the slide off Sawada. He came flying out of the top of the screen, a trail check, ball pops right to Chase's stick and we're out, and probably scored a goal on the other side. Like he just makes great plays all over the field. And yeah, pretty sweet, you know, veteran leader to pick up late in the season.
Those are the film plays we love to shout out on the PLL Happy Hour podcast, Cole. Now, we talk some scheme, we talk some teammates, future possible foes. Before we get to O'Neal and PCAV, just the relationship you've had with Connor Schellenberger through your Virginia days, now him being a second year pro, leading the league in points, friend of the pod, obviously we had him on last week, MVP finalist. What makes Connor Schellenberger so great, and just what's it like covering him in practice?
Yeah, I got to start off with a happy birthday to him. It's his birthday today.
Birthday shout out yesterday for the listeners. We'll have to send him a birthday belated text.
There you go. Perfect. Man, I don't know. I could go on about Shell. He's just like such an incredible competitor, leader, friend, you know, all of the above. I guess I started covering him my freshman year. You know, he just redshirted, and I was on our scout defense for, you know, majority of the year. The reason I got off the scout defense was because I was guarding Shelly every day. he capitalizes on every little mistake or every, you know, odd movement that you would do. He is always like surveying, always making his teammates better. And when it's his time, he'll step up and go make a big play himself. So, you know, I saw plenty of it for 4 years at Virginia. And it's pretty darn cool to watch it in the PLL now. I have to say, like, all the ones that we did, all the 6v6 reps in practice, all the, you know, lifts you know, timing, we'd always hit like a little Monday lift together after a Saturday game, just get the body right and get back into the week. Like he pushed me to get a lot better. So really grateful for him and excited to see what happens.
And just a couple guys from the ACC days, you went up against Pat Cavanaugh, Brennan O'Neal. What makes their game so special, and What's it like covering them and everything and game planning for them?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, so that was an awesome storyline all year in the PLL, like four Thornton winners on the Outlaws. And like, yeah, when does that ever happen in sports? You know, like so cool. But I mean, both those guys, like, awesome to have gotten to play against them so much in college and have had, you know, great battles and see the success that they both had. You know, it's hard to find like a physical presence like Brennan out there, like anyone else out there. So, you know, that's obviously a major plus of his game, and the way he shoots and finishes, like all that stuff is pretty awesome. So, you know, pretty excited to watch him and Chris Fate go at it. It's always a really cool matchup. I remember watching that in college too. Like those guys are unbelievable. In terms of, you know, Pat, you know, we had a lot of battles with Notre Dame, ended our season, unfortunately, junior year and a pretty crazy game in Philly, but you know, he's just an amazing player. He reminds me of Shelly a little bit in the way that he's able to find his teammates inside, make everyone else around him better, and attack hard. And just be scrappy out there, just grinding for every extra possession, loose ball and stuff. And pretty lucky that we have his brother doing it at such a high level on our team, because, man, Chris is a savage. He's been absolutely killing it. So, yeah, it's been fun.
You mentioned Chris Fake. Just mentioned Chris Kavanaugh. You guys, you know, between the coaching staff and the roster, you got about 38 guys named Chris on that team. How do you go about keeping track of all of them when you're, you know, trying to get their attention? Is it all last names, or how does it go exactly?
Yeah, there's a lot of, you know, head turning around in the bus and stuff like that when we're trying to have conversations. And it's not even that. The first and last initial are oftentimes the same. Chris Conlin, Chris Collins, Cole Kirst. Myself, Chris Cav, like it's ridiculous. But maybe there's something to it. Who knows? It's a good group.
Winning formula for California here. You heard it here first. Now we talked about your transition from ball back to lax and a little about Chase here, just from an overall locker room vibe standpoint. Just, you know, you guys win your first two, lose five straight. Now you're winning four straight. Like, what's the attitude, and how much does it match my kind of outsider's perspective of you guys just have nothing to lose and everything to kind of prove to, not everything to prove, but just coming up against a team that might have more pressure on them to get to the title game.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've had to play with that mindset for the last, I don't know, 5 weeks or so, maybe even longer. And you start to really buy into it. It's pretty cool, you know, the power of what that does. And Coach Kelly is just an incredible motivator, you know, not to mention all the lacrosse accolades and ability he has coaching from that perspective, but just in terms of how he motivates and picks up every single one of us and challenges us, like, it's pretty special to have that. So, that's been a fun way to play. And, it's helped us have a lot of success.
Well, let me just kind of carry to what Kevin was just saying. Have you felt like you've had something to prove, you know, a couple losses there that it sounded from, you know, what your coaches might have said, or, you know, some people higher up. It was like, you know, a couple things gone wrong here or there, not necessarily an indictment of the team. Is it something that you've kind of been able to wear on you, that everybody's rooting against you or thinking that, you know, maybe you didn't have a chance against, you know, your previous opponent? You know, maybe did you guys feel like you were getting slept on a little bit, even though you'd kind of come in with some wins?
Honestly, not too much. I don't think that. I think that, like, when you're in the room and you're incredibly confident in the ability of everyone, like, it's what other people are saying doesn't really matter. It doesn't have too much traction with all of us, you know. So, I think that might have alleviated some of that pressure that, you know, you could perceive or stuff like that. Like, it was really just a whole lot of belief in the group and from the entire coaching staff and GM and everything down. And And, you know, that's what we've seen.
Thank goodness, because you wouldn't have come on the podcast if you saw what I was saying. No, but the way that and we talked a lot about this last podcast with Phil Shore, just having such a new young group in this league can go one of two ways, right? Like either you're kind of looking for help with just how fast everyone is, or you can just show everyone just how good this young core is in a young man's league. So I think you guys have done that. I do want to touch on Chris Kavanaugh for a minute with you. Just one, has he offered to string your head yet? And two, just what's it been like from your perspective playing defense, preparing in these night before practices all summer with him, just to see him lean this offense from sliding into the second round to now being kind of the rookie of the year front runner here?
Definitely. Yeah, he has. Yes, I haven't taken up on him. I haven't taken him up on it quite yet because he's got plenty of heads that he's got to get done. And, you know, I got a couple of good sticks and a buddy, Trent DeChico, a San Diego Seals guy, who's been stringing a mine out here. That being said, you know, it's pretty cool and unique when you think about our attack line and, like, you're prepping for a game. You have Chris Kavanaugh, who's I don't even know if you could even debate that he is the most explosive player in the league. Like, he's unbelievable what he does out there. You have Dylan Malloy, who's just like a beast and physical, can get to the rack whenever he wants and can challenge you that way. And then you have Ryder, who's the most crafty, skilled, like one of the most relentless players out there. So, like, you have three completely different looks who can prep you for almost anyone you're going to see out there. Like, that's a pretty cool asset for us. So when we're, you know, out there Sunday night this week, we'll get a bunch of different looks from those guys. And yeah, they make us a whole lot better.
I will say Andrew McAdory would like a word in terms of.
That's for sure. And thankfully, I don't have to deal with him when I'm down at close because I saw plenty of him playing attack it when he was at Duke. Those were always crazy tough matchups guarding him.
Right, right.
And you know, he does it all for us. So I could for sure go on about Mac. Yeah.
You mentioned kind of a variety of different guys you would have to cover. Everybody's coming from a different sort of direction. Somebody just help me out with this because I'm an offensive player, so I don't really understand the defensive mindset. You got basically a week to get ready for your next opponent here. How much of your focus is on, you know, preparing against certain individuals that you might encounter, and how much of it is, you know, strictly worrying about yourself being ready for things like, you know, footwork and elements like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say it's about both. I would say it's probably about 50-50. You know, you want to make sure you're taking care of your matchup and everything you need to get done from that perspective. But you know, the part's always some to greater than the whole. You know, like the Outlaws offense or the Chaos offense last week, like they work really well together. Like all the teams do at this level. So you're doing a lot of film prep and watching, you know, all the schemes that they put into place. So it's a good balance.
And just to carry on with that a little bit, as far as the preparation goes, from a mental standpoint, do you consider yourself somebody who takes more of like a level-headed approach? Do you get kind of psyched up and mad to get out there and play? How do you kind of describe your mental approach to playing defense?
Yeah, I'd say I'm relatively level-headed. Try not to get too high. Try not to get too low. Just realize there's a whole lot of opportunities to make plays out there. And if you make one, great. On to the next. If you don't, great. You're on to the next. And yeah, it's definitely helped me a lot as a defenseman.
For holistically, you mentioned the four Tourton winners. You're coming up against the Denver Outlaws here in the semis. That's Jerry Bernhardt, Pat Cav, Logan Wisnowskis, Brennan O'Neill, for those who weren't aware, weren't aware. Have you been surprised at all, Cole, just how well they've been able to share the ball and kind of share the burden offensively when you guys prepare for them?
I wouldn't necessarily say surprised. Like, I think you could imagine, like, you know, if you were comparing this to an NFL team, you had three Heisman Trophy winning receivers. Not that, you know, that happens every now and then. That'd be pretty rare. But you know, the ball can only get thrown to so many people, and they're making plays. Like, lacrosse is so fluid. There's so many touches and stuff, and as high caliber and high level, you know, players they are, it's not too surprising to me. So it's definitely, you know, pretty crazy looking around and seeing that type of personnel out there on the field. But when you have the group on defense like we do, it's also pretty crazy looking at that too. So, yeah.
Let me throw it back real quick. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, being able to suit up in California, having that sort of environment. What was it kind of like to understand that you were going to be a member of the California Redwoods? Just having the background that you did, it rarely happens in the sport, happens from time to time, but like, you kind of get to carry that flag with a little bit extra for you. What's that sort of been like?
Definitely. Yeah, that was I felt like a lot of pride in that for sure. You know, lacrosse is growing rapidly all over the country and definitely throughout California. And to see, you know, I got to coach at my high school this past year while I was at Stanford with our lacrosse program, and Blake Kim, like my high school coach at Menlo, and so cool to see, you know, the level of competition and how skilled these, you know, student athletes in high school are. It definitely just makes me proud and grateful. Like, you know, I grew up with four of my best friends who all had aspirations to go play college lacrosse, and all did, you know, coming from Northern California, didn't go back east, didn't, you know, do anything like that during high school or middle school or whatever. Like, we just, you know, worked, played together and all had, you know, an awesome experience. So it's cool to see that becoming more and more.
Yeah, give him a shout out here. You'll be playing on September 1st. You know, the class of 2027 will be getting some calls and some visits on that day with their recruiting opening up. Just from you know, you mentioned being on the scout team at Virginia, working your way up. Just did you think you were gonna make it to the pro ranks when you were just a NorCal lax recruit?
No, definitely not. definitely not. Yeah, I mean, I was so excited to have the opportunity to go to Virginia and so excited to be a part of the lacrosse team. But maybe until this year, I always kind of just viewed myself as a basketball player. You know, it's just, that's what made me go to lacrosse, and I got to give basketball a shot, and it was awesome. Learned so much from it, wouldn't have traded for anything. And was cool to get to come out of it and be a lacrosse player again. So yeah.
And who were the four friends that you grew up with? And
Yeah, these are my best friends in the whole world. Talk to them every day. Live with one of them, Samson Axe. He was a short stick D midi at Richmond, dual sport athlete before, actually too, at Trinity College playing football, which was sweet. Finn Leshley, another buddy of ours, just graduated from Harvard, D midi there. Brendan Murphy played at Franklin and Marshall, was a captain and a stud there. And then Ryan Young, played at Lafayette for a couple of years and transferred out. But yeah, a lot of work with those guys put in. So yeah, grateful for that.
Shout out to the boys.
Yeah, yep. It's a good crew. You know, so you mentioned time at UVA, and you also mentioned you know, kind of missing the 10-man ride element of the game, kind of the, you know, flying all around the field. Obviously, no pressure here. You got bigger fish to fry. You know, you're on to the playoffs. But during time at Virginia, we saw at least a shot a season from you. Haven't gotten one on the board yet. Have you kind of been hungry to take something and make something happen down on the other end?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I think our transition game is getting better and better every week. So if I got an opportunity, I'll think about this conversation we had and go for one for you, Chris. So
we'll play the clip. We saw Chris Fake running the field in the quarterfinals. Yeah. We got to see Cole Kastner get one in the semis.
For sure. I appreciate it.
We'll leave you off with this, Cole. Just we appreciate you. You're giving so much time here. This is usually a Rosie question. So, Rosie, I apologize for stealing your thunder here.
By all means.
We read in Phil Shore's feature about you in the PLL site that, you know, Rosie usually asks about your welcome to the league moment. You answered playing against Dylan Malloy in practice. I do want you to describe that, but what moment against an opponent, an opposing offense, was your welcome to the league moment?
For sure. I mean, without a doubt, the first one is Malloy. Like, that just... You see how it goes on the field for other people. Like, he's such a beast. So yeah, definitely that. I'd say on the field, when we played in Fairfield, I was guarding Shelley, which was, you know, pretty sweet, and we talked about it a little bit. And you know, as the game was going on, I felt like I had a pretty good game. And when I checked the stat sheet, he had 7 assists. I was like, "Geez, that this is what it's like playing against this guy." Like, you can do as much as possible, right? Whatever, it doesn't matter. He's always going to get it done. So, that was a pretty big welcome to it moment.
A fantastic answer to leave off on, Cole. We appreciate you joining the pod, and good luck in the semis here.
Awesome. Thank you for having me, guys.
Thanks so much, Cole, for joining the show. It's always a pleasure talking so much ball with the pros in this league. Rosie, one of the comments that stuck out from him right there was one I was asking him about the Torton guys being on the same team. I don't think it's fully set in his mind that he's playing these guys this week, because he was like, so cool, right? Like, that's so sick.
Yeah, just taking the evening to kind of appreciate, man, that's an amazing lineup. Can you believe it? It's like, well, you better, because you got to go stop them.
The Pat Kavanaugh versus Cole Kastner matchups over the years have been worth the price of admission. So definitely excited for that and everything involved with this matchup, Rosie. Like, anything else from either that interview or this matchup stand out to you?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I always do try to stay neutral, but I am 1,000% rooting for that gentleman to cross midfield and go get himself a bucket. I think we need to see that. I'll absolutely blow up, press box or not. I will be screaming for that if it happens. But yeah, the thing that obviously you got those guys, you know, you got your O'Neills and your Kavanaughs over there on Denver. Certainly an intimidating prospect to try to stop them, but I'm always concerned. If I'm an opponent about that transition game, you know, it is just such a backbreaker. If you have an offense that you think is generating a good shot or getting some good ball movement, and then, you know, maybe a midi tries an alley shot with a low angle and it goes right in like McNaney's stick. And then all of a sudden, you know, split second, they're going the other way, right? Because as soon as you shoot it, you got Ryan Tarafenko already breaking downfield. So, you know, if you better miss the cage or something if it's not going in, because next thing you know, you're turning over your shoulder and the ball is behind you. And then, you know, they're about to score a goal because the offense is so solid. Right. So I feel like if you're going against Denver, part of it is kind of just making sure you aren't making too many mistakes, because, you know, they possess the tools to really make you pay for them. So I think that's one of their key hallmarks, almost as much as that Tuarton lineup.
It's really well said, Rosie, because it's a little bit deterring Cole Kastner to take a shot against Logan McNady right
there. Yes, yes, yes. I see. I have it is difficult for both of those things to exist, I suppose, now that you mention it. That being said, just go for it, right?
A man wants what a man wants, and that is that. No, it is a really intriguing matchup, right? Just in terms of holistic bird's eye view of their respective seasons and what has been expected of them. The Denver Outlaws built a juggernaut over the off season, and Coach Tim Sudan was like, "What the heck? Where's my attention, man? I just got Pat Cavanaugh to play with Brennan O'Neill. All right, let me get Jared Bernhardt, then I'll have your attention." 7-3 season. They cap it off with a wild game in an epic potential title game rematch or preview. We'll see about if the Water Dogs have anything to say about that. Rosie, what do you think about this 1 month off, rested Denver Outlaws up against a nothing to lose Redwoods team matchup?
Oh, so here's the thing about the 1 month off thing. I was thinking about this a lot recently. I think what's going to happen with it is it's kind of painting the Redwoods in a corner where their influence on this game is going to be grossly misunderstood, right? If the Outlaws go out there and they stink up the joint, it's all going to be about, oh, they had this month off, right? Because like that's a direct correlation to having a month off. And that's going to be the story. It's going to be, oh, maybe they took too much time off, right? Or if somebody gets a cramp, they're going to say, oh, hey, maybe it's because they haven't had as much game time recently running and their muscles cramped.
100%.
Like, people don't cramp all the time, right? Like, it's going to be the story. And it could just be maybe the Redwoods, who are coming in super hot, right? Like, as hot as we've seen them, just getting better and better. We just saw Chase Erland putting on the game of his life. These guys are peaking at the right time, both offense, defense looking sharp. Maybe if they just have themselves a good game, jump up and hit him in the mouth a couple times, maybe they win. And it's not going to be because the Denver Outlaws have been relaxing at home. But I'm worried that if that's the case, they're going to assign too much of it to the concept of resting. That being said, if they win, I think it's going to be something else, and it's never going to be a focus on the Redwoods. I feel like the month off is kind of a trap on everybody observing this game. It is a trap for us to all fall in one category or another and not so much discuss what the teams are doing. And I'm just saying we should all be aware of it and not inherently fall into the trap.
Oh, I'm fully in. I no matter what happens, rest or like a month off is gonna be a rough first half for Denver.
Or they could come out and drop 28 goals.
And in which case, the Redwoods, they got as far as they could. Man, was that rest helpful.
Right. It's all going to be
about, but it never rest. Is, right? Like, one of the things that maybe I and we take for granted covering this league and being a part of the sometimes repetitive press conferences is, like, they only practice once a week, and Staggs is like, yeah, these rookies got to get used to that. Like, Aiden Carroll didn't have the best first half, and he turned things around, finished with 4-1, yes. But, like, for young guys to transition from practicing and playing every day and honing your craft with your college team to doing once a week and then the game is big enough. Not that the Outlaws are really over relying on any rookies, but it certainly is a storyline that I think deserves a little more merit than I think you're giving credit for.
Well, I think we will, I think it will all be based on the result of the game. And then we will, you know, kind of reverse engineer.
Sure. I mean, hindsight is 2020. You can say that, but like, you have to admit that the rest is so disadvantageous for the Outlaws that it almost makes their like runaway favorite status, like, it totally neglects it, right? Like, it could not be more even because of how you staged it and how red hot these Redwoods are.
Maybe. Unless it isn't, though. That's the thing, you know? Like, I can't say the teams have a half-life, and if they don't play, it's going to continue to make them worse. Obviously, you do want to stay fresh, right? You do want to make sure you're getting your reps in there. You do want to make sure you're not, you know, kind of falling apart during your time off. They had one practice, but obviously practice isn't a direct, you know, direct replica of a game. So is there certainly the possibility that they come out a little cold to start off? Sure. You know, maybe the sticks won't be as fine tuned, you know, maybe, you know, these are all possibilities. And if so, then perhaps rest could be a factor. If the opposite happens, if they come out looking great, it's certainly, I don't know if rest will get the credit. So I think it'll be more a factor.
Sure,
they've
sure.
been a dominant team all year. You know, and if you have, you know, if Brennan O'Neill scores a bunch of goals, it might be rest in his case, because we saw him dealing with some lower body situations when he was last playing. I think it was a cramp, but, you know, and all
yeah, that. Yeah, he was saying RJ in that video, I think. It was a cramp issue.
Yeah, so I'm sure he probably would have been fine. I'm sure he didn't need a month to recover from a cramp. But, you know, that being said, I feel like if they do a great job, it will largely be chalked up to them being a dominant team. And if they don't, then I think the conversation will be like, maybe they rested too long. But if they do great, I don't know if the rest is going to get them the credit either. So
totally fair. And I look forward to switching previews this week on IL.com for your pregame takes on how things might shake out. Because, like, one, they have a starting goalie who does not lose in the semifinals. Logan McNaney, 4 national championship game appearances at Maryland. They have leaders who will not let, like you mentioned, this outside media narrative to even form, because Jesse Bernhardt diving plays from Ryan Tarasenko out there is going to be really helpful in those early minutes flying around. And once they get a couple hits in, I think they'll be fine. Once they see the barn burner that is surely New York versus Philly in that opener, which I do want to circle back on real quick, they'll probably be fine. So we'll see how we assign the gamers and how this frames certain recaps. But we'll be certainly talked about on next week's podcast. Anything stand out to you in terms of when I ask for either most important or overlooked key of the game that you think pops out in your mind right away for Denver versus Cali?
Another thing, I really think, having seen how California dealt with Carolina, how the Outlaws defense handles the pick game that California kind of rolls out is going to be tremendously important. You know, are they going to try to switch more often? Are they going to try to fight through the picks more often so they can stick with the original matchups? I think when you look at a team like California that really does a lot, not so much in the way of assisted goals, but more so in the way of kind of, you know, using their feet to kind of generate the shots they want. You kind of fall into a situation there where Denver's going to kind of have to approach it a different way. You're not really trying to force them to be shooters because they're all looking to be shooters. So I'm really kind of curious to see how Denver's going to approach that, if they are in fact going to try to want to, you know, stay on their matchups or employ more of a sort of looser defense where they can kind of, you know, switch and say, you know, I'm covering whoever's in front of me more so than I've got to stay attached to this one guy.
Can I just say, switch the Josh Balcarcel screen, because he is going to make the on-ball defender ram right into him and fall over. And it's been an absolute joy to watch Chris Kavanaugh score every time off it. So, so switch the Balcarcel screen and maybe switch some more while you're at it. Make these guys feeders, like you said. That's some great analysis. And while you come to the PLL Happy Hour podcast, for New York Philly, 2019 was the last time. Well, that is a year, but also the final score of the game, believe it or not, in week 11. So you know this is going to be a really good game. I think the first time they met, no CJ. So this is the most important data when you get all three of these guys together. And there's a defense that couldn't stop them. Clearly the most two loaded offensive teams in the East. Which playoff defense do you trust more, New York or Philly?
That's a really good question, because you threw in the word playoff to it. And New York, if we're talking strictly the reverse of analysis and just on the sort of out in the universe vibe-ish sort of thing, has not been very successful in the playoffs. And that doesn't mean they're not going to be successful. I'm just saying in the past they have not been. So, do they deserve the trust more than, say, the Philadelphia playoff defense, where they had a lot of their, you know, say, their championship run with somebody else in goal? And like you mentioned, their kind of big three has seen some changes. I mean, if I had to pick one, I certainly like the lineup that the Atlas have rolled out there at close defense. You know, I think Gavin Adler has been largely fantastic. And also, it is tough to say. All of this comes with the caveat that they did just have a 2019 game, right? So it's not something I can say, you know, okay, this guy is straight locked down, and this guy, they've all just gone through a game where they gave up a ton of points for both of them. But I think the individual components of New York's defense, also when you throw in Danny Logan into the mix, could kind of tip things in their direction a little bit. But, you know, we'll see kind of from a sort of goalie down situation, what does playoff Entman look like at the pro level? I think we still need to see that sort of thing resolved, give him more of a sample size to see what he does as well. Obviously, the assumption would be he carries over and continues to what we've seen traditionally with a pretty strong level of success by him. But playoffs are a different animal. Pro playoffs are also a very different animal as well. So, I mean, if I had to pick one, I guess New York, but I think there's a whole lot in the air for both of them.
Bill Tierney said it in his post-game remarks. One of the first things he thought about when winning his first PLL playoff game is, man, now I got to play Teat and Shelley. It's a rough assignment, and one that will surely keep one of the best defensive minds in terms of the sports history that lacrosse has ever seen. So, I mean, like, yeah, like, it'll be interesting for sure. Like, preparing for either one of these attack units, and we saw last year the one game sample size for Entman in the playoffs. Obviously, overtime has not been kind to Atlas fans the last season and a half or so. And, yeah, you think any stat, key, underlooked, overlooked part of the game stand out when looking at these two teams?
Well, let me ask you real quick. What did you think playoff defense-wise between those two? Do you think the are you liking the Water Dogs coming in as their kind of first year at this galvanized unit? Or do you think like a playoff defense Atlas with a little bit under them in their present form that we've seen before is something that's going to help them now?
Yeah, I mean, I was avoiding it precisely because of the like you're coming up against these two offenses. It's like pick your poison for both, right? Like, I do like the Water Dogs' ability to kind of maybe throw some junk stuff at New York, and I'm interested to see if they have the gall and ability to respond. If you throw something at Jeff T, to limit his touches, but it's been an MVP season for Connor Schellenberger then, and when you throw things more at him, then Xander Dickson feasts inside, and Matt Traynor can go off in the midfield. So there is a little bit of a rest versus rust factor for them too. So I do like Philly's defense in terms of, you know, some young guys who are hungry, as I mentioned with Hudgens, Freehill, Brower liking that Shelley matchup. Ben Randall has, you know, tried his best on Jeff Teat, as most have, and Jimmy Freehill's length could be key for kind of clogging up space in the middle with Xander Dickson. So give me the Water Dogs for now. I really like Dylan Hess in the open field. Give me Matt Witcher's defensive IQ, Dartmouth. Shout out for the Ivy Leaguers. DC got a shout out from Tierney post game for kind of collecting that man down unit together and getting them all on the same page for a pretty lethal Maryland unit last game, and a pretty integral stop when they are receiving a 2-minute penalty for a pretty bad cross check to the head there. So could come down to, again, who is more efficient in the 32 with Baptiste staying on the field, how much Alex Stathagis can get into the game, if at all, and how much can Zach Currier muck things up, and maybe Ben Ware can get a transition goal here or there. So a lot of different factors that I threw at you, Rosie, but yeah, give me Philly.
Very nice. Doubling back to what you asked me, I do have to wonder about contributions of offensive midfielders. I don't expect another game where zero production comes from, you know, zero goal scoring comes from the Philadelphia midfield. Although, you know, New York does have quite an intimidating defensive midfield core there. But yeah, you know, I just want to see if you're going to have somebody like a Jack Hanna, is he going to put some goals on the board? Or, you know, kind of take a little bit of the pressure off of, say, Sowers or Kirst as far as, you know, carrying and distributing go. When we see somebody like Currier, we mentioned earlier, with all the ground ball work and sort of attacking the opponents, maybe settles up more in the kind of settled 6-on-6 and does a little bit of distribution as well. Or, you know, just kind of goes out and gets some shots for his own. And on the other side, I think the past couple of weeks especially have kind of illustrated how much New York has relied on and found production from Reid Bowering, especially as of late from as a goal scorer. You know, we talked to Shelley about that kind of thing in particular. You know, he's been contributing a great deal, you know, and kind of in the pick game and sort of you know, filling in the cracks on what could make an offense that's a really, really good offense into a, you know, really great or unstoppable one. So I'm really going to be paying attention to see what kind of a game somebody like a Reed Bowering has as well.
Which is why, not to single Mikey Schlosser out, it's great to see him out back in the playoffs. But didn't register any stats. Thomas Bekonvi only gets one missed shot in there. So I'd be interested to see if you add Jake Taylor to maybe replicate some of that Reed Bowering effect with some pick and slips, some dirty business inside and getting free and mucking up the two and three slides for other cutters. So that's what Jake Taylor does best. We haven't seen him the last couple of games as a result of CJ Curtis moving back down attack. And, you know, to become a glorified man-up specialist is not really feasible in the PLL when you can only roster 19 in on game day. So that would be a lineup decision that I'm looking forward to most when the game day rosters come out. And yeah, should we give some predictions? Who we think will go to the title game?
Sure. Let's hope everybody stops listening now. And so
they're a treat if they made it this far in the podcast.
There we go. This is the hidden track. This is the billboard, bulletin board material.
Right, right. Cole Kastner is still listening. He's in the lobby and anxiously awaiting our answer for the second game. Rosie, I won't make you go first for both, but I will make you go first for the first one. Philly at home against the top-seeded Atlas. Also kind of a disadvantage being the top seed and playing in a hostile environment.
Right.
Who do you like? What's the final score prediction?
Man, this is a very difficult one, despite what we just, I guess almost because of what we just saw. But yeah, you mentioned it. You got the hometown Philadelphia Water Dogs. Home field advantage this season was not actually a thing, but that being said, going to Subaru Park is a little bit different, I feel, than, you know, having to play back-to-back games at Villanova or something like that. This is a different atmosphere. Is it enough to help them get by a team that is 7-3 and well-rested but not too rested? Sheesh. I do feel that the Atlas have fewer questions. Bill Tierney is constantly kind of having to make sure he is tinkering appropriately with the lineup and things like that. Like you just mentioned, you know, what does a Jake Taylor do? What do we go with as far as the goal play? I'm thinking it's just going to be Matt DeLuca again after winning the last one. So where do we go from here? And also, is this the time New York can win themselves a playoff game? Who? I'm going to say, let's go ahead and say yes. We're going to say New York continues the tradition of people having terrible times in their own backyard this season. give me Trevor Baptiste, Teat, and Shelley in the New York Atlas. I think it's going to have to be high again. Go 17-14. Something bananas like that.
No way. That was the exact score I was thinking of during your long filibuster as you thought of an answer. But for the Water Dogs, I'm going 17-14 Philly to advance. I do hope we get overtime. I do really hope for a really tense, at least give us tense fourth quarter clutch moments. And, you know, if you want to add in an open goal or two to make my score prediction right, then so be it. California versus Denver, I will go 16-11 Denver. I think California starts off maybe 6-7 goal lead in that first half and goes quiet in the second half when Denver remembers how to play lacrosse after a month off. And Yeah, I think the California is not a team used to playing with the lead. They have come from behind in almost all of their wins this season, and I think it won't be fun playing against a team that's like, oh crap, our back's against the wall, and you have four Torton winners who can pick you apart.
Man, so I kind of want to pick opposite direction. The question would be, am I doing it because I believe it, or am I doing it because I don't want us to gang up on one team? And we will never know the true meaning of me picking the California Redwoods. But I think I'm going to do it anyway. California Redwoods, I like that they are consistently producing, have been working together with little break, little hesitation, getting better at the right time. They're a scrappy little squad. If it comes down to some clutch goalie play, if Chase Erlin is, we'll say, 90% of what he was in the last matchup, they're going to have a great time. If he is like 75% of what we saw this past weekend, they are going to lose the game. You know, no pressure to Chase Erlin, but I really think it is that close. I think he's just going to kind of have to stand on his head once
again. No wiggle room against Outlaws.
Yeah. He's just going to have to stand on his head again like he was doing against Carolina this past weekend. So if he does that to a degree, to a significant degree, I think they got themselves a puncher's chance. So whether I believe it or not, nobody will ever know. But I am going to say California Redwoods 14, Denver Outlaws 12. Yeah, let's go with that.
I can pick so another 14-12 win. I like the consistency there. And two, I'm imagining a scenario where, you know, Denver had a dud all game. They came back. They made it a one possession game, 13-12. And our boy, Cole Kastner, over the head check, gets it the other way. Dylan Malloy falling to the ground, finds the trailer. Who else? Cole Kastner. And then Stars and Stripes. Who you got? I'll take the Stripes.
I guess I'm taking the Stars.
I don't think it's actually called. Is it? I don't think that's their team names. If it is,
I don't believe it is. I'm taking the Navy Seals because Navy Seals are dope.
I would have to agree. So the one thing we agree on in this podcast, Navy Seals will win the third contest of lacrosse. The script is in. The script writers will be at work inside Subaru Park this weekend. So some live coverage out of your boys. And if you like what you heard, leave a review, tell a friend. Thanks so much for listening, and keep it here on for all things PLL on InsideLacrosse.com.